Welcome to The Blissful Life, a podcast where we awaken the wisdom of self and explore the lessons, the rituals, and the pathways to inner bliss. I'm your host, Regina Lawless, former corporate executive turned author and spiritual teacher. And I'm on a mission, y'all, to help people connect to and express their divine self so they can make their unique impact on the world. If you've been feeling like there is more to life than the hustle and grind, then you found your tribe. It's time to breathe and relax into the blissful life. Welcome back to The Blissful Life. I'm your host, Regina Lawless, and I am excited today to welcome a friend and someone who I think you all are going to enjoy. So Ingrid Hudal is joining me on the podcast today. And Ingrid is an author, speaker, and leadership coach. She is the founder of a coaching and consulting business dedicated to empowering the next generation of leaders. With over two decades of experience in learning and development, she brings her expertise to a wide range of industries, from corporate and media to nonprofit and social justice organizations. Welcome to the show, Ingrid.
Thanks, Regina. I'm so happy and honored to be here with you.
Oh my gosh, I couldn't have thought of a better person, not only because I have always adored you and enjoyed working with you, but you have a beautiful book that we are going to be talking about that I can't wait to share with the audience. So speaking of how we met, you know, of course, we used to work together at Meta, and both in the DEI department, right? Because you're on the diversity learning was, well, kind of straddled.
Yeah, I was like learning, but I was hanging out with you all, DEI, because it's focused on inclusion. Yeah, but oh, what work we did.
Yeah, what work. And I remember the first time we had a meeting, first of all, I was like, this lady has, it was, first of all, you had your red lipstick, not dissimilar to what you're wearing today. And I was like, love her already, because that red lipstick is popping. And you're warm. You were just immediately, you were so warm and friendly. And I was like, okay, I can work with her.
Thanks, Regina. And likewise, you know, you were such a badass leader, poised and also so approachable, which just made everything all the better. So it was so wonderful to work with you.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm excited to talk about your new book. So comes out in June. Yay. Can you tell? I know. Oh my gosh. Yay. You have. Oh, yay.
Surprise.
For those, yes. For those watching on YouTube, you get to see the beautiful book cover. Can you tell the audience what your book is about and why you decided to write it?
Absolutely. And it might shock some people to hear that it actually came from losing my mom. So right out of the gate, death has an interesting way of spurring action. And I realized that, you know, my mother didn't live long enough to tell her story and to write her memoir. So for me, this was first and foremost a way for me to honor her, to share her story, our story, which was tough. It wasn't all, oh, wow, mother, daughter. It was challenging. And to share that, to also then, secondly, give hope to people who are choosing themselves, their truth, living boldly, and keeping close to them love and forgiveness all throughout their life, because you never know how long you have to live. You never know when your loved ones will pass. And being part of that journey, I think, is really important to show people that you continue to live and you can continue to thrive, but you have choices you can make. And so why not really look at the things that make us who we are and choose who we want to be?
So beautifully said. And I'm so sorry for the loss of your mother.
Thank you, Regina. I'm sorry for the loss of your husband.
Thank you. And I think that's why what you just said resonated so much with me, because similarly, that was the catalyst for my own book. And I'll ask you in a second. I want to dive deeper into what it was like to try to write with that grief. Let's go there now, because you did talk about this book is an honoring of your mother's legacy, which she really came to life for me while reading this book. So that was really awesome to see her honored in that way. What was it like, though, to try to take that grief and transmute it in this story?
Oh, it's a really good question. I'm sure you and I have a lot of similarities with this. For me, when I was writing about things that were really deeply painful, for example, there's a section earlier on where I'm young and I'm listening in while my mom on a Sunday is re-recording her voicemail greeting, you know, when it's like, hey, you've reached blah, blah, blah. And as a career tech pioneer badass, came to the States for graduate school, didn't think she'd meet the love of her life and get married at a young age, and then also have a daughter right away. But listening to that re-recording and her shame and frustration in her accent othering her, and me trying to remind her, like, who cares, you know, and you sound great, like, let's go get an ice cream. And her shame really pushing that love and shedding of that shame away. Like, it robbed her of that experience. It robbed us of that experience. And I wanted people to see that, because there were times in my career where that's come up around accents. And, you know, if I felt compelled to, I'd share that story and I would tear up a bit. But in the book, I think it's important for people to realize those moments that are painful are really important to share, because it can provide so much freedom and meaning and a guide to other people. Like, I hope a parent potentially who has an accent reads that and reconsiders, like, the value they're putting on something like a voicemail instead of embracing themselves and their family. And vice versa, I hope a young kid who's hearing something that their parent's struggling with has the bravery to show up to that parent and say, hey, I see you. We're the same. I'm being othered too, but we're here together. You're not alone. Like, that's an empowering place to be.
Yeah, it is. And I loved that story in the book, as gut-wrenching as it was, because it made me connect with your mother. And I think it humanized her in such a way, because kind of being in the tech industry as well, I know that feeling of not necessarily rehearsing a voicemail, although I know I've done that.
Me too.
But rehearsing what I wanted to say in a meeting, or rehearsing for a presentation, and just being so hard on myself and spending that extra time to perfect it because I didn't want to be perceived as unprofessional, or just wanted to always put my best foot forward, which is impossible to do. But I thought you wrote about her in such a realistic and balanced way. And she came to life. All of your characters came to life. And the grief, I could see reading it, and I'm grateful to have gotten an early copy of the book. I could certainly see your honoring, and even through choosing to put something like that where it just shows some of her pain. And so I can relate to that for sure, because I struggled with how do I capture the memory of my husband in my book, for example. But be honest with where he struggled or where we maybe struggled in our marriage. So I don't know about for you, but for me, that felt freeing just to put the good, the bad, and the ugly on the page.
Oh, 100%. Like, what was so freeing also in also the processing the grief in writing because it was hard. Just like you, there are chapters and moments where I was like crying writing it and then crying rereading it. And thank goodness I'm reading the audiobook now and haven't cried. Like, I think I've been so prepared now. I'm like, oh my God, we're good. But I want the readers, similar to you, to feel that pain, because we all have pain and every one of us is going to experience grief if we haven't already. So we're all in it together in many ways. What I was going to say was so interesting about connecting the dots of my mom's journey. So you sort of see that pain and her, like, in that moment, you know, maybe in her 40s at the time, being this like tech pioneer, breadwinner, struggling with that. And then you see towards the end of the book where she's a completely different life. She's literally in an internship for a social work master's degree. It's her third master's degree. She's much older. She's in her 60s. And she's interning for no pay, literally having these conversations with elders in the LGBTQ community all throughout San Francisco, who, it's a suicide hotline. And in this one instance where she's coming back, as she's staying with my wife and I for the summer, and in this part of her journey, which was like a really hilarious and also gut-wrenching experience for those of you who read the book. But there's this gentleman in this 10-minute call who outs her about her accent. And in 9.5 minutes later, they're deeply connecting. And she comes home and she tells us the story about how like that happened. But what she remembered was this wasn't about her. It was about this person who was in pain. Like, they called because they wanted to end their life. Wow. And the fact that my mom had evolved so much to say, that's not going to hurt me. Like, that's on you, but you're hurting. Let's talk about that. How can I support you? I was just like amazed, like, at my mom's growth. And I think honoring her and also processing the grief is to remind myself that even though I don't get my mom in these elder years of her life, like, they were, it feels like they've been robbed from us. But man, did she live a full life. And I want people to take that away and see that, like, that is true. And it could be for any of us. Like, we could be having that self-actualized moment at any point in our lives. So why not drive all of our forces and energy and love to get there? Like, that's the point.
That is absolutely the point. Oh, beautiful. Reading your book, I was struck by how descriptive the language is. So experiential. Like, I felt like I was transported into your story. I really felt like I had a good understanding of your two grandmothers, for example. You do such a good job of describing them and just other characters like your mother and in the book. Why was it so important for you to make it immersive or to make the reader feel like they were on the journey with you?
Oh my goodness. And you and I both know, because thanks to you, which I put in my book, thanks, shout out to Regina, introducing me to our writing coach, Stacey Ennis. She really pushed and encouraged me to sit with the experience. Like, I had to sit back in that experience with the 5-year-old. I was 5, right? And I'm sitting at the bus stop where this 5th grader calls me half piece of shit. And it's one of those instances you want to run away from. But Stacey's like, no. Like, what time of year was it? Was it cold? Like, what were you wearing? What were you feeling? Like, go back and really think about it. And it allowed me, and I think the descriptors from having Chinese be my first language, to go back and really paint this picture and like seeing in the distance this willow tree and thinking about these carbon copy homes, and does everybody have that same feeling about me and my family being different? Really getting in there and like, why did I not tell my family that, like, why was I hiding? Like, I had a lot of realizations writing the book. I'm like, oh my God, I never told them that. So why didn't I tell them that? I was like, oh, I think I wanted to protect them. Like, that was my only little kid way of protecting them. And then scenes like with my white grandma, Graham, where she's like, you know, really feeling heated, and I don't recognize it yet as racism. But we have this moment where I'm like, no, I am them. The people who you're having all this vitriol about is me. And she's like, no, it's not. Like, you're my grandmother. I'm like, no, I'm your grandma. I'm your granddaughter, but I'm also them. I wanted both sort of white and folks of color to read those experiences and be in them, to really feel xenophobia in a way that might help us have the social collective awareness to challenge it or break free from it. Because it really is oppressive. Like, we're all sort of squeezed into these very uncomfortable boxes that are threatening, harmful. And I think it's important to show people from an innocent young person's shoes what xenophobia looks like when you're in between. Because that's not common.
No. And I want to pick up on two things. Like, there's the thread of xenophobia and the experience of that and being othered through both of those stories. But with the first one, and shout out to Stacey Ennis. Yeah. He is a fantastic coach, was my coach as well. And you're right. She pushes you to really be descriptive, and you nailed it with that story. Cause the human side of me was like, where he at? Where's the little boy? Can we find him now? Where is he at?
I know. Me too.
But you know, the spiritual me was like, peace and blessings to him. Okay. He didn't know any better.
I don't know. But do we have to go that route, Regina?
But you know, we... but the second story, I wanted to really touch on that with your white grandmother, because you did such a brilliant job with that story, because you made what other people could read, or if you had written it slightly differently, she would have just came off as racist. But the way you made me empathize with this woman who really grew up in a way where she went through some things herself. And through you, I think it opened her up to difference. And I think it's such a great metaphor for how so many people don't realize that the very people that they may fear or judge are their neighbors, are their family members in many instances. So I just thought, I really appreciated that, how you made her not a caricature, but a real person that we could examine from different angles.
Thanks, Regina. I appreciate that. I know. I think you even were, thank you again also for endorsing the book. Like, I'm so honored. But we were chatting about that scene. And one thing I would like to add is, you know, a lot of people don't necessarily know the context. I think that's what you're getting at too. And looking at my grandmother, you know, at first I think she's like a badass with a lead foot and kills spider crickets and right. And then you kind of see she's kind of stunted in her development. She's broken. She has mental health issues that, you know, no one's really helped her identify. And she gets kind of lodged into like radio, and a specific kind of radio that gives her a sense of superiority away from her brokenness. Yeah. And I think that's an important thing to see from the in-between. It's like a lot of these characters have experienced brokenness, right? Gender, power, race, class. And it's what we do with our brokenness is the opportunity to live boldly. And that's what I really want people to see too, is like, you could be so broken down. What are you going to do to help yourself still have the essence of you and not allow that to completely get rid of it? Like, You got to nurture it at all costs.
Wow, what we do with our brokenness. What a powerful thought. I hope as people listen to this, they think about that, because we've all been broken at one point or another, or will be. We are all going to go through something that makes us feel broken inside. And I agree wholeheartedly. You have a choice to make what you do with that, with those circumstances. Speaking of race and power, and you tackle race and sexuality and difference and, you know, being othered so poignantly in this book through the various stories and characters. Given all the discord in our society right now, what is something you wish people would take away from your book and in your overall journey?
Oh my goodness, that it is a never-ending journey to have awareness and empathy around connecting with ourselves, our story, and other people and their stories. Like it's a flow. You got to allow the flow. We can never stand on a riverbank, which I use as a metaphor in the book, and just kind of say, I know what's up, like I've arrived. No, that's you stuck. This you got to get in the river. You're on a boat, like move through it. That's the work that we have to do. We can't get too comfortable on these precipices because they're it's like a farce. I also find, you know, unraveling the years of what was deep-rooted internalized homophobia. Like I bring you through that in my journey. I think it might help people who make a big assumption like, oh, you know, people are choosing to be gay, or they're choosing to be trans, or they're it's like, oh my God, like, look, if you are somebody who has come out and said, I'm a lesbian, I'm trans, I'm gender nonconforming, what has brought that person to that point is so tremendous and bold and truthful that you can't really be somebody on the receiving end on that precipice and say, no, you have no idea how long it's taken to get to that place and to be that much in bold courage around that place. And so, again, I hope people read this and they see the years. Like I've had people who are, you know, very, very straight be like, I wanted you to be gay so bad. And I'm like, yeah, me too. And they're like, no, you don't understand. Like, I was like, just touch the girl. Just come on. And I was like, really? Like, that was what you got from that? And they're like, yeah. Like, what were you so scared of? I'm like, okay. Wow.
But have you not lived in this
society? I know. But I just think it's really important to notice, like, it's not like I grew up where people were hating on gay people. I just had never seen that being a possibility for me. And I think when I talk about Star Trek, TNG, you know, nerdy moment here. Again, it was like, nice. The first time you see people of color in these roles, women in these roles, interracial kisses, you know, same gender kisses, like that's the kind of stuff we need more of, these stories and representation. And DEI is really important work because there's nowhere else people are getting that kind of unlearning. Re-education, like the humanity that truly is going to get us through some serious shit is what DEI has been set up to do. And I think the fact that people have somehow single-handedly said, no, that's not important, is basically saying, no, humanity in this moment is not important to me.
Okay, if you don't preach on this day... So much goodness in that. First of all, I appreciated you taking us through your journey of grappling with your sexuality. And I remember the story in the book around kind of going to college and having a crush on, it wasn't your first per se, but I won't give the story away, but because I want everybody to read it. But I thought you did a nice job with that internal tension. And it wasn't just as soon as you got away from home, you're going buck wild and you're fully out the closet, you know, the proverbial closet. But you illustrate that struggle. And I thought that certainly resonated with me, because you're right. I've always felt, why would someone choose to be ostracized, to be othered the way that we do people who are gay, trans, lesbian, who are just different in general in this society.
That's right.
Who are underrepresented in general. So I have so much respect for people who are standing in their truth. So I thought you demonstrated that so beautifully in the book, getting to that, getting to your authentic truth. And then with DEI, let's go there, because with DEI, it has gotten such a bad rap, and we know very intentionally and very deliberately. And some people are just sadly just altogether ignorant and don't. I really do believe that the large majority of people just don't fully understand what these terms mean. Mm-hmm. And you being a leadership coach and an L&D professional, I know you have created so many different inclusion-based learning experiences and events. What do you hope for DEI moving forward? You talked about DEI really being synonymous with humanity, and I couldn't have said it better myself, but I'd love to hear more of your thoughts of, you know, where do we go from here?
Yeah, you know, it kind of gets me thinking about language. You know how language changes and our terminology changes a lot, like even throughout, you know, our four decades or so of living. I just think about even like reclaiming the word queer or the term queer.
Yeah.
There are some like racial slangs for those of us who are Chinese that I'm not going to repeat, but that has not been reclaimed, and that's okay. But there are things that get reclaimed and shifted. And I remember being in DEI and be like, wow, these terms are changing fast. Uh-huh. What I didn't expect is literally for the acronym of DEI, diversity, equity, inclusion, or even the B, belonging, to have such like
visceral
reaction to it, right?
It's crazy.
And I, you know, for a while, I was seeing people who were like, hey, hold on, here are like 100 different things that DEIB has done. It's not what you think. But then I was like, well, what are people thinking about this? And I try to go back to like the B, you know, belonging. I grew up, never felt like I belonged in any group or category. People are always trying to make me go into a category. Do I feel like my work is to make me feel like I belong somewhere or be part of a community, or, you know what I mean? So maybe that doesn't always fit with me as the receiver. However, if you take out the words, if that's triggering for people as DEIB, truly unlearning the shit that we learned that reinforces harm, division, forcing the boxes that we ourselves do not want to be forced into, needs to be interrupted if we are going to work better together, if we're going to have even like robust companies innovation. Like, it's like the same thing. If you just look at simple bias, right? Like similarity bias is a great one. If all we're doing is hiring the same people, we're not going to do anything great for the company. The company will probably phase out very quickly. And I think about my team members who are of all different backgrounds. It's not just race. It's not just right. But the differences in how we work and understand things and the way we work together to challenge our notions to be creative, I have found that in those environments where people feel safe, where they can challenge, have healthy debate, really come together with all of their unique brilliance, the output of that is so much more at a magnitude than any of just tens of me's to do alone.
Right. Yeah. Right?
So I'm kind of like, are we talking about you just want to like have carbon copies of the same? Because that's called robots.
Right. Or minions. I like to joke, like, I don't need minions to hire some minions. Like, it's so interesting. I connect with everything that you just said. I was doing a guest lecture a couple weeks ago at Santa Clara University, and I was talking to a class about DEI. And one of the things that I started with in my lecture was my favorite definitions for diversity, equity, and inclusion. And then I showed some visuals. But one of the things that really made me feel good after the class is that, and during, based on the questions they asked and the feedback, but several students came up after the class and were like, wow, like I loved your definitions. Like it made me think about this work very differently, like what DEI is very differently. And one of the things that I had them do was talking about diversity and how, I don't know, I'm sure you've probably seen the iceberg.
Yeah.
And so I brought that into the class to show them that so much of what we think is diversity, and I think this is part of how diverse DEI has been able to be co-opted, is that we think of it as just race and gender.
Right.
So just the things that you can see. But through the iceberg, I had them think about, look at all these things under the waterline of visibility.
Beautiful.
All of these things that we all are. So all of us are diverse as human beings. All of us bring some unique brilliance, some genius. And then we went into, of course, why that's important to include our differences and how that gets to better outcomes. But belonging is something that I've been anchoring to as well. And something I ended that lecture with is that we all have a fundamental human need to belong and to connect with one another. And if we lose sight of anything else, even if you have every other weird objection to DEI, I don't see how you object to people wanting to belong to something and to feel as if they're heard and seen and valued. And so that's how I've been thinking of DEI, whatever it morphs into in the future. I think that companies will be remiss if they don't find ways for people across all these different dynamics and dimensions feel like they can be included in the work, because we know people will just leave. Or they'll turn into minions and your products and services will suck. And people just want to belong. We want to belong. We want to belong as humans. That's a fundamental way we're wired. So so we'll see. Girl, I'm like, it's been a shit show to say the least.
I hope in the show notes you add your definitions and the iceberg, because I think your listeners are going to love that. I definitely want to point to that as a resource for folks, because it's so true. And I think for those of us who are outsiders, what you're saying about connecting and like what we're sharing too about humanity, I think people can't lose sight. Like, it's interesting that DEIB has sort of had this like horrific response, which I think there'll be a pendulum. A lot of people are talking about the pendulum. But then you have, you know, amazing researchers like Brené Brown, right? Who's always talking about vulnerability.
Yes.
And when we talk about inclusive leadership, a lot of the foundations of being an inclusive leader is emotional intelligence and having the self-awareness, social awareness, how you manage the way you relate to people, thinking about the ways that you have a lens and challenging the assumptions that you might have. Like it's very much just how to be an evolved human and shed some of the things that you might have learned growing up, which many of us have, that aren't
all
useful,
of us have.
Right? Aren't you? Yeah.
Yeah.
To you, your team, your career. So what's interesting is like that could be true, right? Okay, yeah, emotional intelligence, empathetic, listening, empathetic leaders, super important. It doesn't come necessarily organically to people, and you have to practice that all the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, Simon Sinek talks a lot about trust and trusting teams and vulnerabilities and about, you know, having to cry all the time. But it has the humility and the prioritization of humanity to want to do the work, to be curious enough of what does cultivating trust look like for each member of my team or organization that helps us collectively feel like we can bring the best of ourselves to work. And it doesn't mean all of ourselves, because shoot, I hope I hope not everybody's like, hey, my identity is this job. Like, oh, that's not healthy.
Right.
But the beauty of the expertise and the differences that we each bring, because we're all very different and yet very similar.
Yeah.
How do we as leaders then use all those skills to create an environment of super high performing and very empowered connected teams? Like, this is a science. It is an art. It is a practice. And DEIB is a very important application and a framework and honestly a value for leaders to lead and succeed well into the future, period. Like, hard stop.
That is true. Yeah. Yeah. And humility and humanity are the two words that really stick out to me, because as a leader, I don't see how you can be an effective leader if you don't have the humility to say, I cannot possibly have all the answers.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I cannot possibly have all the answers. So let me utilize the brilliance of my team or those
around me.
So that's something I always prided myself on as a leader. And then the humanity, that is something that's learned, because I think so often we're conditioned to conform, which denies our humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And so I love it when leaders, and hopefully those listening to you, to us, can think about how they are allowing people to show up as the unique humans that they are, because through that, people will bring their best selves. So cool, the work that you're continuing to do and building inclusive leadership and teams. Like, that is, to me, sacred work, especially in these times.
100% agree.
For sure. And I'm going to take your tip to add, I will link in the show notes, the iceberg graphic and then my definition.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a gift to all of us. Thank you.
I love it. So with all of the wackiness that is going on in the world, how do you maintain your bliss?
I very much have gotten into a place in my career, in my life, where I'm letting go of a false sense of control. And I find that the more I create an environment of harmony for myself and those that I love, for the teams that I have the honor to lead and to partner with, and the more that I can create space for harmony in nature and in the unknown, I actually experience more bliss as a result. And that's what I want. I would love more bliss, more flow, more gentleness to kind of see where the river takes me, and to accept what the universe has in store, because that we cannot control. So letting go of control, because it's a false sense. No one is ever happy, I think, when they're like, I'm in control, right?
Right.
It's false. And I think it can be very addictive. So when I coach people, which I am accepting clients, by the way, for your audience to know.
Yes. You better reach out to her, y'all. Y'all hear
Please,
her.
Please, yeah.
You hear this Here wisdom. Mm.
I look out for that because I think people got addicted to the dopamine or the rush or the anxiety that comes with being on the hamster wheel. And you kind of see yourself in the hamster wheel. Well, why am I don't want to be on the hamster wheel. But there's too many things that you kind of get or you're used to, you're addicted to. And so having the choice to kind of step off that and to look at that and to think, what would be the path I want to take? What is the rhythm of that? Where's the harmony? How do I bring harmony into my everyday? And you know what? That might mean you're not the best performer at your job, but if you can be a pretty good performer at life, that's better.
Yes.
So that's my bliss right now, is letting go of control and just being in the flow.
We could do a whole nother hour on
that'd be fun. I'm like, oh my god.
Right?
Slow.
Me could do a whole nother hour on letting go and being in the flow. Because when I tell you, that has led to me arriving at this place of bliss as well. And I didn't realize how tightly wound I was, how much I wanted to control everything and game everything out and have all these contingencies. And then my husband died. And it took the wind being knocked out of me and going through that grief journey to kind of sit back and laugh at the universe like, oh, okay, that I never had control to begin with. Okay, got it, noted. But there's something powerful in coming to that awareness and hopefully through our example and many other stories out there, people can get there without tragedy. But I find tragedy is often the best teacher, fortunately or unfortunately. But you're right. You are so right that when we let go and just let things flow, which is super scary to our ego and our mind. Our mind's like, what the? What? But yeah, it's so much more peaceful on the other side.
Oh, I also found that your book is fantastic. By the way, I know you're asking me to talk about my book, but your book is fantastic. And I hope the listeners have all bought your book and are reading the book, because I'm not going to share, obviously, because you should read the book. At the very end of your book, Regina, when you see on your phone, I'm just going to say that I was both crying and felt so much joy for the gift that it's like everything we're talking about, too. It's sort of the culmination of the gift, receive, universe.
Yes.
And I have chills just thinking about it. So I hope people get to read your book if they haven't read it and have that same experience, because it's just such a hopeful, beautiful reminder of how little control we have, but how amazing some of the signs and the whispers you talk about are potentially, if we listen and we pay attention, are leading us there. It's really beautiful, your book.
Well, thank you for that beautiful plug. I appreciate that. For those who don't know, let me do a little shameless. I always keep my book around. So do you. Maybe I'll link it in the show notes too.
And please. So good.
So that's actually a great segue, since we're talking about books. Because I would love to link, even if it's like a pre-order, or where can people find your book when it's released in June?
Thank you for that question. Right now, folks can go to my book website, which is just sunshiningonmorningsnow.com. But on June 11th, I would love it if people went to their favorite online distributor. So that could be Barnes & Nobles or Amazon, and you'll be able to buy the book there. You can also ask your local bookstore, and they can go to Ingram Spark and place an order. So those are the ways you can get my book on June 11th. I can't wait to physically hold up my book too, but I don't have it yet. But that's how you can find my book on June 11th. So mark your calendars, please.
Oh, I love it. I can't wait. I'm such a tactile reader. Like, I love to physically touch the pages, smell the book, and highlight it. And all the things you're probably not supposed to do with a book, that's me. Like,
it's our generation, Regina, too. It's our generation.
Aging ourselves, but you know, you can tell. We're 22. No, I'm actually having way much more fun in my 40s than I did my 20s.
Same.
As an aside. Yeah, right.
Talk about bliss. I'm like, okay, here we go.
Exactly. Who knew? Okay. Who knew?
She's fierce. Right? She's fun.
She fierce. She fun. She a goddess. I love it.
Yes.
So, okay. I will absolutely link the book's website in the show notes. And like Ingrid said, mark your calendars, June 11th. You have to pick up this book. I am not just saying this because this lovely human is my friend. I have read the book, y'all, and it's a beautiful read. My absolute pleasure. I really do want people to read your story, because it is so powerful. and just has so many lessons and ways for people to see themselves. So,
and you're on the back cover.
Am I? Yeah. Surprise!
I know. I had to drop that at the end.
Oh my God.
Your endorsements, Regina.
Yay.
Thank you, girlfriend. Yeah,
my pleasure. My pleasure. Okay. So you are taking coaching clients. I know. I know people are going to want to stay connected or find you after this. Where can they find you and connect with you?
Yes. If you are interested in connecting with me, you can go to my book website, which I shared, or my coaching and speaking website, which is just my full name, Ingrid Hu, which is HU.com. And you can also email me at hello@ingridhudahl.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you, Regina, for having me join your podcast and be kind of a sister author in the journeys that we've had.
Yes. Well, I'm so grateful to you, Ingrid, for coming on the podcast. It's always a delight when we get a chance to see each other and talk to each other. And from my heart to yours, I'm sending you so much love and success for this book and the journey beyond.
Same. Thank you so much.
Thank you, my dear. Thanks, everyone.